Good morning and welcome to Brass Talk Sunday for the 28th day of October 2018. I'm your host and one of the moderators for today's program. And today we are having the moderators roundtable. We have the moderators standing by to examine the issue of austerity 2018 and the future. So unfortunately, Miss Lisa Gill, she's unable to join us today, but she says she's listening in. Also with Mr. David Ellis. But on the line, we will have Mr. Glenn Murray. He's on the line already. And in studio, we have Mr. Sanka Price and Mr. Peter Wickham. The numbers remain the same, 434-1790, and the WhatsApp, 266-4862. Easy to remember, 266-IVOB. Now, before we get down to brass tacks, we have to remind you that this program is brought to you in association with Williams Industries Incorporated. For building surprise, big or small, at Williams Metals, we have it all.
Angles, flats, cement and doors, lumber, windows and much, much more. Get all your lumber needs from us. We have number one treated pine, all different types of plywood, V-joint, siding board and concrete board. In addition, we have grade 3 2x4s and form ply for boxing. Big or small, at Williams Metals, we have
it all. At Williams Metals, we have it all. Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
Yes, now let's get down to business because I know how these things go. We start, we get the assize, and then quick, it's 15 minutes after one. Now, as we examine the austerity, I want us to make a distinction between the austerity itself and the implementation of it. Because when I'm listening to people on the ground, one of the things I believe people are doing, they're mixing up the two. And I believe it's two different things. During the discussion, for me, I also like to hear some talk on possible alternatives to austerity. Why? A lot of Barbadians out there are speaking about things in relation to, let's take some examples, couldn't we have been placed on 4-day, 3-day, and so on. Now, what I am not hearing, and my disappointment, is really towards the fact that I haven't heard any economic sports person, and I'm not saying it was not said, I'm saying I haven't heard. Now, as someone who follows current affairs, if I'm not hearing it, there's a possibility that others are not hearing it. You may need to turn up the ante on it in terms of explaining why we didn't take alternatives. Now, before we start, we also have as producer and technical operator, Mr. Dennis Johnson, and he has a microphone as well, so don't believe that he'll be able to run away from this discussion either. So, good morning and welcome, gentlemen. Let's talk about austerity 2018.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Who is going first?
Well, why don't you?
I thought Corey is a man with the button, he can say it.
All right, brother or myself. First of all, Corey, I have to disagree with you. I don't see, I'm trying to remember how you can separate the austerity program from the implementation. If you leave it only as an austerity program, it's kind of abstract, esoteric exercise that has no realistic day-to-day implications for people's lives. I think you can only evaluate the austerity program based on what it seeks to do and how it's implemented and the effect on the society, whether it's achieving its direct goals or not. I am not disputing that there was need for an austerity program of some sort. All I'm saying is you cannot make this artificial distinction between the austerity program and effects on the persons it's meant to serve.
Fair enough. That's it for your opening?
That's my opening.
All right, now. Who goes next?
All right, I can follow Glenn. My thing as a political analyst is to look at this program and compare it with the other two that we would have had in 1991, being the most recent, and then the other that we would have had in 1981, which Glenn probably would know more about than me, because I don't really have a memory of, certainly I don't have a remember of any major austerity in that period. And what's clear to me is that this one was approached in a way that was very different. I'm sorry, Corey, but I am not convinced that there are alternatives that are so glaring. People are talking about putting people on a 3-day, 2-day situation as opposed to what's being done now. And, you know, the reality of the situation is that we have too many people working in the public service. Too large a percentage of Barbadians who are employed within the public service and are doing jobs, quite frankly, that would not exist were they in the public service. And someone made an interesting point that the only place you can find clerk typists are in government or University West Indies, Barbados Community College, or some other statutory organizations. They don't exist in the private sector, and they don't exist for a very good reason, because the technological advancements have moved in a direction that have taken us there. You would remember in the 1990s, all the major companies severed their team of drivers and hired private contractors to deliver goods. So if you buy something from Coats, a Coats van don't deliver it. If you buy something from Coats, it is delivered by a private contractor who is contracted based on a percentage of the value of the product to deliver that good. The private sector has been able to turn a corner in relation to developments. Government sadly has not. And it is painful. I think it is most unfortunate that the government has to be taking this position. But I also think it is inevitable. And I think that in 10 years to come, we will look back on this period and we will say, thank goodness that some government had the intestinal fortitude to chart us on the right path in terms of the way that we develop. It's a conversation that goes on in several other countries. I mean, I was in Dominica this week, and their public sector is similar, you know, where it is characterized by a lot of posts that people hold that, to me, don't bear a relevance to the 21st century of modes of operation. Having said that, I think that the way that it has been deployed is novel. We didn't have a situation where we just had an election and then we had austerity dropped on us. We had a situation where government went to parliament first and increased public servant salaries. Government also gave concessions in relation to tuition fees and in relation to the petrol tax ease, which, of course, was compensated in another way. But to me, you set a base, which Prime Minister has explained, that, look, I'm giving you the capacity to carry the weight. And then the austerity came. So the approach was an interesting strategy where you fulfill your promises up front, and then you deal with matters of austerity. And I think that the political strategy is a novel one. I think it's an interesting one, and I believe that it is one which will bear fruit in the long term. The challenge, however, is that the other phase, which is the idea of growing our economy, building out our economy, that is the important part, which is going to take a few years to come. And I think that when that happens, it's going to be very interesting.
Okay.
All right, Sanka here. Mm-hmm. Austerity program was needed. Quite frankly, we have been padding the public service for too long. All governments have been doing this. And I've spoken to this before about what Prime Minister Fonda said back in 2014 when he was addressing the National Union of Public Workers. And I made that point that, in fact, Mr. Stewart said that in 2001, the Oenatha administration was advised that the public service then had 26,000 persons and they should have been downsized by 10,000 persons over a 10-year period. And I'm going to quote here, this advice was on the basis that it took 36 cents out of every dollar of expenditure to pay wages and salaries, and this was thought not to be sustainable. Okay, and that was back in 2001. He's now speaking in 2014. And he said that path was not pursued. Since then, the public service has grown much larger and it now takes 54 cents out of every dollar to meet public service wages and salaries. Now, the thing about it is that this was an inevitable event. It had to happen. It needs to happen. We need to restructure what we do. Last week, Sunday, I had Caswell Franklin here, as well as Verla de Pisa and Ryan Strawn and Dr. George Bell. And one of the things that I put to Caswell is the manner in the attitude of the more senior people in the public service and how they will deal with the change, because it's a workflow thing. Eh? The fact about it is that in most private sector organizations, most people do their own typing. It's like par for the course. You don't be sending something to typists and this and that. So let's get real here. We have got to make this change. But of course, with every change, we get the emotive language, we get a lot of emotion because people are losing their livelihood, and we get that level of emotion coming out. And that is what I'm seeing, a lot of emotion. But the reality is that we have got to start thinking of how we are going to do our business in a way that is efficient and practical. And the last point I'm going to make very, very quickly is, Corey, here looking at me. This idea of three-day work, 3 or 4-day work week, or cutting people's salaries and whatnot, is one of the most efficient and, myself, one of the most city strategies that anybody could think of. Why? You have to plan your business in such a way that you are, if people have a 5-day a week job, they are going to be paid for 5 days a week. It's a level of stability. They have come to rely on it. They've come to rely on a certain level of finance. And you have to manage your business that it can take care of your people as well. You're going to have three, give me a second, Glenn. And if you have, if you are going to say you're going to just run your business any old how, and then when things get bad, just cut people's salary or put them on three, maybe the window is 3 day, 4 day a week, you're cutting people's salary. That is not efficient. So we have to start we have to disavow ourselves of those thoughts.
Glenn, before you jump in, because I was making notes, there's lots I want to respond to as well. I want to hear from Dennis, and then we could probably take on each other and then open up the lines and hear from the public. So let's hear from Dennis first.
Two things. One, I believe that the tightening of the public service was necessary. However, I don't think the country was ready for austerity. I think there are two generations of Barbadians who have no idea what tightening your belt means. They just have no concept of it whatsoever. So I don't think the country was prepared emotionally or even financially for an austerity package, one. Two, the 5% increase, I would have liked to have seen a 5% cut across the board of expenditure. I'm talking about the price of goods and services, a 5% cut in it. I think it would have gone farther than a 5% increase in public worker salaries or even an increase in pensions. What the country is faced with is a cost for goods and services that's not commensurate with the value of what's being presented. That's my feeling. There is nothing that says that our energy bill should be as high as it is. The cost of fuel on the world market drops, but it's not reflected here because of the way we've set up the importation and the pricing of fuel, which drives transport, which increases cost. That's one of the basic increases in the cost of doing business in Barbados. The other thing is the odd way we operate. We talk glowingly about, you know, communication. But we still stick to an 8-to-4, 9-to-5 regime, except in the hotel sector. There are other agencies that could operate outside of the 8-to-4, 9-to-5 cycle that we seem to be stuck on. I agree, and we keep talking about clerk typists. Driver messengers are also obsolete. Right, but they're just components. They're people. We see the function without seeing the people, which is why I said we weren't ready for an austerity package. People were still glowing in the, you know, the aftermath of 30 zip. What I would like to see, and I have not seen or heard, and Peter said it's going to take longer, and I bow to the political scientists, but the how we earn. We can't live on loans and luck, which is what we've been doing for too long. And we have to find a way to earn. And I do not believe that putting all our eggs into the tourism basket is going to earn. And the other agencies that were set up to earn foreign exchange have been faced with various international blows. So we have to change what it is we do to make money, hard currency in Barbados. And that has to be done parallel to an austerity program. It can't be done after, because people are going to be psyched out of producing. And too many people are sitting saying, well, give me a little handout to tide me over. When you get caught in that cycle, it is hard to lift yourself out of it. And that's why countries that go into IMF programs stay there for so long, because people get hopeless. And that's my opening bat. My opening salvo.
Go ahead, Glenn. Go ahead.
Yes, I like to talk about two or three areas primarily. First of all, I like to disabuse and explore this myth about the public sector. I do so as having worked in the public sector as an employee. And secondly, I have to have had the rare privilege of being having the responsibility for the public sector when I was Minister of State in the Prime Minister's Office and the Ministry of the Civil Service. Right? Okay. And I really deprecate where people seek to make laugh and sport at job titles. Behind our job titles are people. The name has changed because of changed circumstances. The time when we had typewriters, but you still call your secretaries, there will always be a need for typing. The things a permanent secretary, for example, cannot be expected to go to a meeting, come back, type notes, research, and type and send it to the minister. He's too busy doing that thing.
Why not?
Somebody perform that role.
Why not?
But you call them because it just doesn't work that way, Dennis.
Of course it works that way. It works that way in the private sector. I see CEOs making notes, sending emails and whatnot. Why not?
But the private sector has a different structure and function from the public sector.
Right, and that's the problem, the structure and function of the public sector, Glenn. And I'm glad you said that, because to me, you're reflecting what the problem is. We have a concept of a permanent secretary. A permanent secretary is a CEO. I don't see, why can't a permanent secretary send emails?
It doesn't work that way. The nature of
right, it doesn't work that way, and that's the reason why we are riding horse and buggy in the age of jet planes. And Glenn, your comments are reflective of that. You're saying it doesn't work that way, and I'm saying I don't see why not.
Can I get a chance to say something, please?
Of course.
You spoke at length without interruption. I'm saying that, for example, let's talk about governments padding the civil service. Surely I can speak for the 9 years when I was in Oinata's government. Each job that was created had to have a rationale. If you want to have a clerk typist or messenger driver, a rationale had to go to the Ministry of the Civil Service to justify its creation. It then had to go to the
rationale that somebody needs a job.
Finance, you know, paid for before a job can create it. And jobs, the increase in jobs, three from experience, came with the increase in the services that the government was offering. Like, for example, the Rural Development Commission. There was a need for that. I would seem to be a need. The Urban Development Commission, the National HIV/AIDS Commission, and those other agencies that came to offer, nothing could replace the National HIV Commission because the job it did could not be done through the Ministry of Health. It was determined it had to be put outside the Ministry of Health, outside the creation, for you to be able to service the constituency that was badly in need of service, that had the National HIV Commission, which then had the reference lab, which could therefore give free antiretroviral treatment to people, which is so successful. Some said that certainly from experience, there were rationales created for a job. You might not say, well, the time has passed where these jobs are no longer, but certainly at that time, from my experience, there was need and justification. People not only created jobs just willy-nilly. A minister could not create a job just willy-nilly. It was centralized, it was organized, it was structured, and it was analyzed. It had to be justified. So this thing about Clark typist. There was a time when we had just techno machine that had, they used to do that pink stuff, what they call it now, correcting fluid. And whatnot. That has changed.
Liquid paper.
You said, right, and people used to go to people's office and see them doing correcting. Use the correcting fluid and say, oh man, these civil servants, they're doing the nails, they're painting nails, they're pink. It has changed and it will always change. It'll be further change. So there's no point in declaring what serves its purpose. Now let us see how we can change. I do not see how we can ever prioritize this public service.
We see there's a role for the public service, but the question really is, how do we right size it? And your point is that things have changed. And I want to say that before, clerk typists were kind of specialists in their fields because everybody could not type. We're living in a society and a time now where most people can type, and that was the question. Now I want to put the other side to it before you jump on that, Glenn, because I'm gonna let you respond. But I just wanted to say this. When you look at the situation, a lot of the people that could not type before can type now. And that's the question I think Peter is coming with. The other side of it is this. The government service, public service, whatever you call it, they have all of these things in place and things are really still slow in delivery. When you remove these people, I ask myself, if it's so slow already,
you have to change your workflow.
What is going to happen?
You have to change your workflow. The manner in which how things are done, you have to change it. When you are rationalizing any office, any department, you look at what you have, you look at how it's functioning, and you try to figure out, how can I make this even more efficient so that more can get done and we can do it with less people? That is what you have to do. And that can be done. That has always been done. And we can do it. It's not rocket science. It's been practiced for years.
I know it's not rocket science, gang. But let me give an insight as to how the public service work on a day-to-day basis. The mail comes in. The mail might be direct to the minister, might be direct to PS. Somebody has to go through that road, that mail, and sort out which goes where.
Yeah. So, but listen, Glenn, sorry for cutting you, but that is the reason why I said we need to look at it separate. Because look at the Customs Department. They are complaining already that Lloyd Clark Tavis have been removed and it has slowed down things. And that's why I am saying, hold a minute. This is very, very important. The thing that Sanka is talking about in terms of changing the workflow should have been done before. That's why he talked about implementation.
Analysis of that should have been done.
Dennis talked about ready, were we ready? That should have been done. In terms of the letting go of people, I believe that mechanism should have been put in place that people can transition instead of being displaced and then picked back up. That is the difference between the austerity itself and the laying out of it. Dennis want to make a point too as well. Let me, Dennis, make a point and I'll let you come back.
The question I wanted to ask was, when we created the various SOEs, weren't they supposed to be self-financing? Some of them?
Not really.
Some of them were not supposed to be self-financing?
Some were supposed to generate revenue.
Right. And they've become a drain on the public purse because they failed to do so.
Agreed.
So the question then is, were they equipped? And were they allowed to do what they were supposed to do, or they simply became what the former Prime Minister called sucking on the nipples?
Can I make a couple of quick points? I have to defer to Glenn. I never worked in the public service. I never did, whether it's a good or a bad idea. So there are a lot of things I don't understand. Right?
Okay.
I don't understand, for example, when I call a government department and I sent you an email requesting some information this morning. And I call the clerk, and I have not seen any response. Is there anything you can help me with? And she tells me, I'm sorry, you would have to write the permanent secretary a letter. And Glenn, to me, that tells me all that's wrong with the public service. I am asking a public servant if you can email me in regard to public information regarding legislation that is in the public domain. And I'm saying, can you please respond as the officer responsible? And that person tells me I have to write a letter to the permanent secretary. Now, I don't even really know how to write letters, so I'm supposed to write a letter, print it out, put it in the mail, let it go to the permanent secretary so that that same permanent secretary's secretary can have something to do to read through mail and sort it. And Glenn, you're saying that that's the reason why it has to be maintained. And I'm saying to myself, the problem I'm having is that I think the whole way that we approach it is fundamentally wrong. I worked at the University of the West Indies. I used to correct scripts. I used to put the marks on a grid. I give it to a secretary to key in. And I was told several times, Peter, you cannot do it yourself because it is a role that the secretary has to perform. We got second and third markers, but the secretary had to key that information in. That role has been abolished because a system has been created whereby lecturers now key information directly in, but they still have secretaries. So my question is, what do these people do? And instead of us trying to defend the reason why a permanent secretary's secretary has to sort through letters, we have to get to a system where we abandon all the letters. And it's all right to say, let's change the system first and then get rid of the secretaries. The fact is, the matter is that that will never happen because these people have a vested interest in ensuring that they have something to do. And you know, in the final analysis, that's why it comes down to. And I am not knocking anyone for wanting a job. I'm not knocking anyone for earning a living, for taking care of their family. Those are important rules. But we have to stop seeing the public service as a place where we create employment because somebody needs something to support their family. Remember, we had a prime minister one that says that this creating work is that there's work to be done.
All right, let us hear from Glenn.
Yeah. I'm literally misled you when I talk about permanent. The mail really goes to the registry.
Oh, gosh, but that's even worse. So we got a whole department now to sort letters.
Give him a chance.
Somebody has to sit down physically, sort them out, and decide who goes what and go where. You can't just dump it on somebody's head. And then they process. And some has to go to the finance, to the PS for finance. It has to go to the PS if you can't sell it to the clerk who's answering the phone. So I'm saying that there's one of the things about bureaucracy is often maligned. I'm sorry, Peter, this is what's the matter?
I think that was one of my specializations in bureaucracy.
Right. But there is a
with Professor Nunes.
Bureaucracy is supposed, it works well and it's well managed. It's not about management, you know. It is supposed to have procedures, systems, structure, equality, certainty. The problem is with the public service, like somebody answering the phone, you, that is an attitude. There's nothing, from my experience, there's nothing in the rules or whatever the public service says you have to do that. That is somebody trying to avoid work and inventing an excuse why not to work. So that's an attitudinal thing which is supposed to have been dealt with through public sector reform. But it's not the nature of the job saying this is what you do, what you do. They're not the rules and regulations or whatever the public service. So that is a misconception, really, which can only be, which needs to be put to rest once and for all. And when somebody is a secretary, a clerk type or not, somebody, whether you call a clerk type in the future, a document operator, a document facilitator, that role will still have to go perform.
Documentalist.
Somebody has to
perform. Documentless obsolete too.
But let us close off this part of it, because we don't want the entire program to be about this. By asking this question to you, Glenn, using your experience, because I think your experience may be advantageous and at the same time disadvantageous. Because on the other side of it, I've suffered 21 years trying to cut through this bureaucracy, working with charities and organizations, and I believe it's totally inefficient. You, on the other hand, because you've been on the other side, you see it as totally necessary. But when you take a step back and let us meet each other in the middle, let it be, in all things, let there be moderation. Do you believe that the public service is the right size and it's efficient? If not, what is the better way to address it?
I don't know what is the optimum ideal size for the public service, so I cannot say if it's the right size. All I'm saying is that every bureaucracy, every institution, every organization has its deficiencies, its inefficiency, its faults and its flaws. And it's up to the management, both the top management and the day-to-day supervisory management, to make sure you get the best out of the institution and the best out of the work. That's all it is.
Glenn, I don't think you need to know the optimum size to know that it's the wrong size. All the surveys, all the statistics, all the politicians have said it too big. The Army of Occupation, going right back to Prime Minister Owen Arthur, to Prime Minister Fonda, so every person has admitted that it is too big.
Corey, the Army of Occupation went back to Alabama in 1974.
Right.
Correct.
And it was big then, it's big now.
But I have no doubt it's probably overstaffing something because changing roles, social functions are the need. But I love it. I can't say how large is too large, too small. So it's something that would have to be done through analysis like that in the restructuring. I'm saying where certain departments are going to have to be investigated or more analyzed by the Office of Public Service Reform before CBC or some of the department, I can't remember the details now, which will go under the scrutiny to decide what will be the size that can make what will be the best size for them to function.
Okay, let's take a pin right there. There's some other things I want to look at. Reminding you, we're talking about austerity and the future. So we want to look at the BERT program, the debt restructuring, the layoffs, and so on. And I mean, we can't go in debt in all of them. Each of them could probably take on a program in itself. But let's open the lines at this stage. It's 11:30. Let's take a call. Good morning and welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, I want to refer to Peter Wilkins' question to Glenn Murray when he asked him why not, when Glenn spoke about the PS not taking minutes of the meeting. The reason for that is the checks and balances system within the civil service. The administrative officers from the SAO back down to the AO2 does the minutes. It's a matter of filtering to make sure the PS, not that the PS, he would say the PS is going to put his own information in minutes or write his own thing. It's a checks and balances to make sure that all that have been discussed on all agreements are put there. It's a checks and balances situation.
So what is the direct question?
There was another question. I just wanted to
explain. Will you explain why it's done?
I appreciate your explanation because I have to admit I am entirely ignorant of the public service. And I am ignorant of an environment in which a person who is not in a meeting has to check on balance on a person who was in a meeting, right? I've been to meetings with international organizations and I've seen persons come into meetings as executing secretaries, essentially, or executive secretaries that come, that sit in the meeting, that participate in the conversation, that take minutes which are executed by their same department. I've seen that up front. And I have to admit, ma'am, that I am at a loss to understand why the public service is the only place that doesn't work that way, that a person who is not in a meeting has to act as a check and balance on a person who is in a meeting or who has ultimate responsibility for ministry. So I'm ignorant, and I am happy to say I don't understand it, but I can tell you. I'm sorry?
Am I hearing you wrong? Did you say somebody who's not in a meeting acting as... doing repeat what you said.
You said someone who is not in the meeting acting as a check and balance. So you're saying that at the SAO and all these people are in the meeting?
Yeah, they are in the meeting.
Oh, okay, okay. So we have three people in the meeting right in minutes.
No. Let me come here. A permanent secretary is there with the minister to guide the minister, advise. A permanent secretary cannot be following the discussion, thinking, analyzing.
And the senior admin officer now does what?
I'm taking notes. Right.
So he takes notes. So what does the senior admin officer take?
The senior admin officer will take notes too, that the most junior administrative officer, they will do up the meeting and they will compare. See if they
so then the junior administrative officer taking notes too?
She or him takes their notes.
So we have the notes being taken by the permanent secretary, the senior admin officer, and the junior admin officer too?
The permanent secretary does not take notes for the meeting.
So the permanent secretary gives advice, and the senior admin officer takes notes.
We take the notes.
And then the junior admin officer takes notes too?
If the SAO is there, which is senior administrative officer, is there. Normally it's mostly an AO2 or AO1 admin officer. If the SAO is there, because she has to supervise.
So we have an SAO, an AO1, and an AO2. All of them taking notes.
Mama, let me jump in here to bring some clarity. Glenn and the caller, thank you.
The clarity that we need is clear to me. It is a divide regarding my concept of how an organization can work based on my exposure to private sector and international organizations and how government works.
I think this has been answered by Sanka before. Sanka said you need to reorganize the workflow. She's saying is that two or three people take notes to compare to make sure it's correct. We have, in this age of technology, you can record it with a recording device or something. My thing is, let's move along. We are established that. I want to read these two interesting WhatsApps. We take another call and then we start to dissect some more issues. This one says, good morning, panel. It is interesting to see how people like you moderators come on the air and belittle and devalue public service jobs just because you are not one of the victims. If this was done by the former administration, it would have been condemned by the Barbados Labour Party administration and this panel left, right, and center. I have not heard if they will be getting rid of messengers as well, but I think they should get rid of the VOB moderators since we have social media. This one says, Peter, I work on a statutory board. The clerk typists have very little to do, and everybody knows it. They now communicate by email and intranet. We communicate to each other and other government departments by email, and everyone types their own emails.